to he. It comes naturally. This creature is no object. His name's Odo, Bob answers, rocking nervously from side to side. He's a rolling stone. He was brought over by someone who was volunteering in Africa for the Peace Corps. Then he was with NASA for testing in the space program. Then he went to Yerkes, then Lemsip, before... A burst of shrieking comes from the other end of the corridor. The chimpanzees, who have mostly settled down, start up again. It's even more deafening than when he and Bob entered. Dr. Lemnon has returned.
"Bob, you better have a damn good explanation for this," he bellows.
Peter and Odo let go of each other's hands. The consent is mutual. The ape turns and resumes his former position, his side to Peter, his gaze somewhat lifted. Bob looks as if he'd rather climb into one of the hanging cages than return to the corridor. Peter goes out first. The full menace of Dr. Bill Lemnon becomes plain as he strides down the corridor, his angry features alternately illuminated and obscured by the spaced-out light bulbs, the din of the animals amplifying as he gets closer.
"What are you doing in here?"
he yells at Peter. Any pretense at cordiality is gone. Lemnon is an ape asserting his dominance.
"I'll buy that one off you,"
Peter says calmly. He points to Odo.
"Will you now?" replies Lemnon. "Should we throw in 4 elephants and a hippo? Maybe 2 lions and a herd of zebras? This isn't a pet store! Get the fuck out of here!"
"I'll pay you $15,000.
Oh, the terrible appeal of round numbers. $15,000. That's considerably more than his car cost. Lemnon stares in disbelief, as does Bob, who has crept back into the corridor.
"Well, well, you must be a senator after all if you're throwing that kind of money around. Which one?"
"That one there." Lemnon looks.
"Huh, can't get more omega than that, bozo. He lives in La La Land."
He thinks.
$15,000, you say?"
Peter nods. Lemnon laughs.
"I guess we are a pet store. Bob, you've got a great eye for customers. Mr. Tovey, I'm sorry, Senator Tovey, you can have your pet chimpanzee if you want. Only thing is, we don't have a money-back policy. You buy him, you get tired of him, you want to give him back to us, we'll take him, but it'll still cost you $15,000. You hear me?"
"It's a deal," says Peter. He extends his hand. Lemnon shakes it, looking like he's enjoying the greatest joke in the world. Peter glances at Odo. As he begins to move off, he sees from the corner of his eyes that the ape is turning his head. Peter looks again. Odo is staring at him once more. A quiet thrill goes through him. He's been aware of me all along. To himself, as much as to the ape, he whispers, "I'm coming back. I promise." They walk down the corridor. A last observation forces itself upon him as he looks left and right, something he didn't notice on his way in. He's struck by the chimpanzee's great diversity. He assumed that one chimpanzee would pretty much look and be like the next. It is not so. Not at all. Each ape has its own body shape and bearing, its own coat of hair with its own color and pattern, its own face with its own tone, complexion, and expressions. Each, he sees, is something he hadn't expected, an individual with a unique personality. Bob sidles up to Peter at the door of the compound, looking worried and discombobulated.
"We sell them," he whispers, "but not for that."
Lemnon waves him away.
"Get! Get!"
They return to the car. Peter comes to a quick agreement with Lemnon. He will be back in a week or two, as soon as he can. He needs time to make the necessary arrangements. He promises to mail a check for $1,000 as a deposit. Lemnon agrees to get all the papers ready. As the car drives away, Peter turns and looks out the rear window. Lemnon still wears his triumphant smirk. Then he turns to Bob and his expression changes. Bob is evidently about to be fully dressed down. Peter feels bad for him.
"Had a good visit?" the driver asks. Peter sits back in a daze.
"It was interesting."
He can't believe what he has just done. What will he do with a chimpanzee in Ottawa? He lives in an apartment 5 floors off the ground. Will the other residents accept having a large, unwieldy ape in their building? Is it even legal to own a chimpanzee in Canada? How will the ape take to Canadian winters? He shakes his head. Clara has been dead for just over 6 months. Did he not read somewhere that people who are grieving a major loss should wait at least a year before making important changes in their lives? Has grief caused him to throw away all good sense? He's a fool. Back at the hotel, he tells no one, neither the Oklahomans nor his fellow Canadians, about what he has done. Nor does he tell anyone in Ottawa upon his return the following morning. He spends that first day at home, alternating between denial and disbelief and completely forgetting about it. The next day, he hits upon an excellent idea. He will buy the chimpanzee, after all, and donate it to a zoo. He's quite certain the Toronto Zoo doesn't have chimpanzees, but another zoo, Calgary, will surely take the animal. It will be a stupidly expensive gift, but he'll make it in Clara's name. That will make it worth every penny. There, the matter is settled. He wakes up early on the third morning. He stares at the ceiling from his pillow. Odo looked right into him with his reddish-brown eyes, and Peter said to him, "I'm coming back. I promise." That wasn't a promise to drop him off at a zoo. It was a promise to take care of him. He has to go through with it. Damn it all. He doesn't know why, but he wants to go through with it. Once the first central decision is made, all the ones that follow are easy. He mails the deposit check for Odo to Lemnon. It's obvious that they can't stay in Ottawa. In Oklahoma, science was the excuse to keep the ape in a cage. In Canada, it would be the weather. They need a warmer climate. It's good to think in terms of they again. Is it pathetic? Instead of throwing himself at another woman right away, on the rebound, as the expression goes, as if he were a ball in a pinball machine, is he doing worse by throwing himself at a pet? It doesn't feel that way. Whatever term might be given to their relationship, Odo is no pet. Peter never thought he would move again. He and Clara had never talked about it, but they didn't mind the cold weather, and the idea was that they would stay in Ottawa into their old age. Where will they go? Florida. A lot of Canadians retire there, precisely for the purpose of fleeing Canada's winters, but the place means nothing to him. He doesn't want to live between a strip mall, a golf course, and a sweltering beach. Portugal. The word illuminates his mind. He's of Portuguese origin. His family emigrated to Canada when he was 2 years old. He and Clara visited Lisbon once. He loved the tiled houses, the luxuriant gardens, the hills, the streets of run-down European charm. The city felt like a late summer evening, a mix of soft light, nostalgia, and slight boredom. Only Lisbon, like Ottawa, is no place for an ape. They need a quiet spot with lots of space and few people. He recalls that his parents came from a rural area, the high mountains of Portugal. A return to his roots? He might even have distant relatives there. The destination fixes itself in his mind. His next step is to deal with his attachments to Canada. He considers what these attachments are. At one time they were everything: his wife, his son, his granddaughter, his sister in Toronto, the members of his extended family, his friends, his career, in a word, his life. Now, other than his son, he is surrounded by material relics. An apartment with stuff in it, a car, a pied-à-terre in Toronto, an office in the West Block on Parliament Hill. His heart beats with excitement at the idea of getting rid of it all. The apartment is now unbearable to him, imprinted as it is in every room with Clara's suffering. His car is just a car, the same with his studio apartment in Toronto, and his job as a senator is a sinecure. Distance might improve his relations with Ben. He isn't going to spend the rest of his life waiting around Ottawa for his son to find more time for him. His younger sister, Teresa, has her own life in Toronto. They talk on the phone regularly, so no reason why that should stop. As for Rachel, his granddaughter, for all he now sees of her or hears from her, he might as well live on Mars. She might be tempted to visit him one day, lured by the appeal of Europe. That's a valid hope. He takes a deep breath. It all has to go. With alarming glee, he sets about throwing off the chains that hold him down, as he now thinks of them. Already, when he and Clara moved from Toronto to Ottawa, they rid themselves of many personal possessions. Now, in a frenzied week, the rest goes. Their apartment in Ottawa, such a good location, the agent beams, finds a buyer quickly, as does his place in Toronto. Books are carted away to a used bookstore, furniture and appliances sold off, clothes given to charity, personal papers donated to the National Archives, and knick-knacks and baubles simply thrown away. He pays off all his bills, closes his utility and phone accounts, and cancels his newspaper subscription. He gets his visa for Portugal. He wires a Portuguese bank and makes arrangements for opening an account. Ben helps dutifully, all the while grousing about why on earth Peter would pick up from his ordered life and leave. Peter walks away from it all carrying nothing but a suitcase of clothes, a family photo album, some camping gear, a guidebook to Portugal, and an English-Portuguese dictionary. He books their flight. It appears that it would be easier if he and the ape fly directly from the United States to Portugal. Fewer borders to cross with an exotic animal. The airline tells him that, provided he has a cage and the animal is calm, they will carry it. He consults with a veterinarian on how to sedate a chimpanzee. Through connections, he finds a buyer for his car where he wants one, in New York City. "I'll deliver it myself," he tells the man from Brooklyn on the phone. He doesn't say that he will be taking a slight detour via Oklahoma on his way down. He cancels all his future appointments, with Senate committees, with family and friends, with his doctor. His heart isn't so good, but he packs a supply of medication and a renewal for his prescription. With everyone. He writes letters to those to whom he doesn't speak in person or on the phone. "You suggested I bust loose," he tells the whip. "You sure took my words to heart. Why Portugal? Warm weather. My parents came from there." The whip looks at him steadily. "Peter, have you met another woman?" "No, I haven't. Not even close." "All right, if you say so." "How could I have met a woman in Portugal while living in Ottawa?" he asks. But the more he denies a romantic connection, the less the whip seems to believe him. He doesn't tell anyone about Odo, neither his family nor his friends. The ape remains a luminous secret in his heart. He happens to have a dental appointment coming up. He spends his last night in Canada sleeping in a motel, and the next morning he has his teeth cleaned. He says goodbye to his dentist, and he drives away. It's a long drive through Ontario, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri to Oklahoma. He doesn't want to tire himself too much, so he does it over 5 days. Along the way, from a corner store in Lansing, Michigan, from a diner in Lebanon, Missouri, he calls the Institute for Primate Research to make sure they are aware of his imminent arrival. He speaks to the young woman who told Lemnon about the phone call, the one that distracted him and allowed Peter to visit the chimpanzee compound. She assures him that all is ready. After a last night in Tulsa, Peter makes his way to the IPR, arriving mid-morning. He parks the car and wanders over to the pond. On the main island, two people are having what looks like a sign language lesson with a chimpanzee. A group of three apes lazes about in the center, on the ground. Sitting among them is Bob, attending to a chimpanzee, inspecting its shoulder. Peter calls out and waves. Bob waves back, gets up, and heads for a rowboat that's resting on the shore. The ape he's with follows him. It leaps with ease into the rowboat and perches on a bench. Bob pushes off and rows over. Halfway across the pond, when the boat turns, the chimpanzee, whose view was blocked by Bob, sees him. It hoots loudly and pounds the bench with a fist. Peter blinks. Is that? Yes, it is. Odo is larger than he remembered, the size of a big dog, only wider. Before the boat has reached the shore, Odo leaps out, bounces once off the ground, and sails through the air towards Peter. He has no time to react. The ape slams against his chest, wrapping his arms around him. Peter falls over, landing inelegantly on his backside and sprawling flat on his back. He feels large, wet lips and the smooth hardness of teeth against the side of his face. He's being attacked. Bob's laughter comes through to him. My, my, he's certainly taken to you. Gentle, Odo, gentle. You all right? Peter can't answer the question. He's shaking from head to toe, but he feels no pain. Odo has not bitten him. The ape has instead moved off and settled right next to him, pressed against his shoulder. He starts playing with Peter's hair. Bob kneels next to him. You all right? He asks again. Yes, I think so, Peter answers. He slowly sits up. He stares with wide eyes and breathless incredulity. The strange black face, the thick hairy body, the whole warm animal literally breathing down his neck, with no bars between them, no protection for him, no safety. He doesn't dare push the ape away. He just sits there, alert and paralyzed, his gaze hovering. What's he doing? He finally asks. The ape is still plucking at his head. He's grooming you, Bob replies. That's a big part of chimpanzee social life. I groom you, you groom me. It's how they get along. And it gets rid of ticks and fleas, keeps them clean. What should I do? Nothing. Or you can groom him back if you want. A knee is right there. He brings a trembling hand to it and strokes a few hairs. Here, I'll show you how, says Bob. Bob sits on the ground and, much more assertively, starts grooming Odo's back. With the edge of one hand, he pushes through the chimpanzee's coat against the natural lie of the hairs, exposing their roots and bare skin. After doing this two or three times, he finds a good patch and sets to work with the other hand, scratching and picking out skin flakes, bits of dirt, and other detritus. All in all, a fussy, involving activity. Bob seems to forget about Peter. Peter begins to regain his composure. It's not disagreeable what the creature is doing to his head. He can feel soft fingers against his skull. He looks into Odo's face. In immediate response, the ape shifts his gaze to look at him. Their faces are maybe 8 inches apart, eyes fully staring into eyes. Odo hoots lightly, the panted breath bouncing off his face, then folds out his lower lip, revealing a row of large teeth. Peter tenses. He's smiling at you, says Bob. It's only then that the young man, who is so good at reading the ape's emotions, understands Peter's. He puts a hand on his shoulder. He won't harm you, sir. He likes you. And if he didn't like you, he'd just leave you alone. I'm sorry I got you into trouble last time. Don't worry about that. It was worth it. This place is bad. Wherever you're going with Odo, it will be better than here. Is Lemnon around? No, he'll be back after lunch. A stroke of good luck. Over the next few hours, Bob gives Peter a mini course on Odo. He teaches him the basics about chimpanzees' sounds and facial expressions. Peter learns about hoots and grunts, about barks and screams, about the pouting, puckering, and smacking of lips, about the many roles played by panting. Odo can be as loud as Krakatoa or as quiet as sunlight. He has no command of American Sign Language, but does understand some English. And as is the case with humans, tone, gesture, and body language do much to convey meaning. The ape's hands also speak, as does his posture and the lie of his hair. And Peter must listen to what they have to say. A kiss and a hug are just that, a kiss and a hug, to be enjoyed and appreciated and perhaps returned, at least the hug. The best face is one where Odo's mouth is slightly open, his demeanor relaxed. This may be followed by one of the delights of chimpanzee language, the laughter, a bright-eyed, nearly silent panting, the mirth fully expressed without the grating ha-ha-ha of human laughter. "It's a complete language," says Bob of chimpanzee communication. "I'm not very good with foreign languages," Peter muses aloud. "Don't worry. You'll understand him. You'll make sure of that." "He's potty-trained," Bob tells Peter, "only the potty has to be within sight. Chimpanzees don't tolerate continence for very long." Bob supplies 4 potties to distribute around Odo's territory. The cage that is to be Odo's means of transportation and his nighttime nest doesn't fit in the car. They take it apart and put it in the trunk. Odo will travel in the front seat. At one point, Peter goes to the restroom. He sits down on the toilet lid and puts his head into his hands. Was early fatherhood like this? He doesn't remember feeling so overwhelmed. Bringing baby Ben home was a giddy experience. He and Clara didn't know what they were doing. Do any young parents know? But it was all right. They raised Ben with love and attention, and they weren't afraid of him. He badly wishes Clara were with him now. "What am I doing here?" he says to himself. "This is crazy." Bob and he go for a walk with Odo, much to the ape's delight. Odo forages for berries, climbs trees, asks, with a grunt and his arms raised like a child, to be carried by Peter, who obliges, lurching and stumbling about until he's ready to drop. The way Odo holds onto him with his arms and legs, he feels he has 100-pound octopus on his back. "I can give you his collar and his 20-foot leash if you want, but they're pointless," Bob says. "If he's in a tree, he'll just pull you up like you're a yo-yo. And if you happen to be on a horse, he'll pull your horse up, too. Chimpanzees are unbelievably strong." "So how do I restrain him?" Bob thinks for a few seconds before answering. "I don't mean to get personal, sir, but are you married?"
"I was," Peter replies soberly.
"And how did you restrain your wife?"
"Restrain Clara?"
"I didn't."
"Right.
You got along. And when you didn't, you argued and you coped. It's the same here. There's very little you can do to control him. You'll just have to cope. Odo likes figs. Placate him with figs." During this exchange, Odo has been poking around a bush. He comes out and sits right next to Peter, on his foot. Brazenly, he feels, Peter reaches down and pats Odo's head. "You gotta get physical," Bob says. He squats in front of the chimpanzee. "Odo, tickle fest, tickle fest," he says, his eyes open wide. He begins to tickle the ape's sides. Soon the two are wildly rolling about the ground, Bob laughing and Odo hooting and shrieking with delight. Join in," Bob shouts. The next moment, Peter and Odo are thrashing about. The ape does indeed possess Herculean strength. There are times when he lifts Peter clear off the ground with arms and legs before crashing him back down. When their roughhousing is over, Peter staggers to his feet. He's disheveled, one of his shoes has come off, his shirt has lost 2 buttons, the front pocket is torn, and he's covered in grass, twigs, and soil stains. It was an embarrassingly juvenile episode, unbecoming of a man of 62 years, and utterly thrilling. He can feel his fear of the ape draining away. Bob looks at him.
You'll do fine, he says.
Peter smiles and nods. He declines the collar and leash. When Lemnon appears, there is only the commercial transaction that needs to be completed. Peter hands over the bank draft, which Lemnon inspects carefully. In return, he gives Peter various papers. One form states that he, Peter Tovey, is the legal owner of the male chimpanzee Pan Troglodytes Odo. It is notarized by a lawyer in Oklahoma City. Another form is from a wildlife veterinarian. It gives the ape a clean bill of health and guarantees that Odo is up to date on all vaccinations. Yet another is an export permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They all look properly official, with signatures and embossed stamps.
All right, I guess that's it, Peter says.
Lemnon and he don't shake hands, and Peter walks away without saying another word. Bob places a folded towel on the front passenger seat. He bends down and hugs Odo. Then he stands and motions to him to get into the car. Odo does so without hesitation, making himself comfortable in the seat. Bob takes hold of the ape's hand and holds it to his face.
Goodbye, Odo,
he says, his voice strained by sadness. Peter gets in the driver's seat and starts the engine.
Should we put his seat belt on? He asks.
Why not? Bob replies. He reaches over and works it across Odo's waist. He snaps the buckle in. The shoulder strap is too high, running across Odo's face. Bob puts it behind his head. Odo does not mind the arrangement. Peter feels panic simmering within him.
I can't do this. I should just call the whole thing off.
He lowers his window and waves at Bob.
Goodbye, Bob. Thanks again. You've been a tremendous help.
The drive from Oklahoma City takes longer than the drive to it. He goes at a moderate speed so as not to alarm Odo. And whereas from Ottawa to Oklahoma City he jumped from human colony to human colony, Toronto, Detroit, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Tulsa, on the way to New York City, he avoids as many urban centers as he can, once again to spare the ape. He would like to sleep in a proper bed and enjoy a shower, but he is quite certain that no motel owner will rent a room to a half-simian couple. On the first night, he turns off the road and stops the car next to an abandoned farmhouse. He assembles the cage, but he isn't sure where to place it. On the roof of the car? Sticking out of the trunk? A little ways off, in the ape's own territory? Finally, he puts the cage, its door ajar, next to the car and leaves the front passenger window rolled open. He gives Odo a blanket, then he lies down on the back seat. When night falls, the ape comes in and out, making considerable noise, leaping into the back seat a few times, practically landing on Peter, until he settles in the footwell of the back seat next to him. Odo doesn't snore, but his breathing is powerful. Peter does not sleep well, not only because he is overtly disturbed by the ape, but because of nagging worries. This is a large, powerful animal, unrestrained and uncontrollable.
What have I got myself into?
Other nights they sleep on the edge of a field, at the end of a dead-end road, wherever it's quiet and isolated. One evening he has a closer look at the papers Lemnon gave him. Included among them is a report that gives an overview of Odo's life. He was wild-caught as a baby in Africa. No mention is made of the Peace Corps volunteer, only that Odo next spent time with NASA at a place called Holloman Aerospace Medical Center in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Then he went to the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta, Georgia, then to the Laboratory for Experimental Medicine and Surgery in Primates, LEMSIP for short, in Tuxedo, New York, before being sent to Lemnon's Institute for Primate Research. What an odyssey! No wonder Bob said Odo was a rolling stone. Peter lingers on certain words. Medical, biology, laboratory, research, and especially experimental medicine and surgery.
Experimental?
Odo was shunted from one medical Auschwitz to another, and this after being taken from his mother as a baby. Peter wonders what happened to Odo's mother. Earlier in the day, while grooming the ape, he noticed a tattoo on his chest. Only in that area can the dark skin be made out beneath the thick coat, and there, in the upper right-hand corner, he found two wrinkled digits, the number 65, inscribed on unacceptable paper. He turns to Odo.
What have they done to you?
He moves over and grooms him. One afternoon in lush Kentucky, after filling up, he drives to the far end of the recreation area behind the gas station so they can eat. Odo gets out of the car and climbs a tree. At first, Peter is relieved. The ape is out of the way. But then he can't get him to come down. He's afraid that Odo will reach over into another tree and then another and be gone. But the ape stays put. He only gazes at the forest on whose edge he is hovering. He seems drunk with joy at being in such a leafy haven, a chimpanzee afloat in a sea of green. Peter waits. Time goes by. He has nothing to read, and he doesn't feel like listening to the radio. He has a nap in the back seat. He reflects on Clara, on his disenchanted son, on the life he is leaving behind. He walks to the gas station to get food and water. He sits in the car and contemplates the layout of the gas station, its main building that was once brightly colored but is now faded, the expanse of asphalt, the coming and going of cars and trucks and people, the recreation area, the edge of the forest, the tree in which Odo has ensconced himself, and then he sits there and just watches Odo. No one notices the chimpanzee in the tree except children. While grown-ups busy themselves with trips to the restrooms and with fueling up their cars and their families, children look around. They grin. Some point and try to alert their parents. A random, blind gaze is all they get. The children wave at Odo as they drive off. 5 hours later, as the day is coming to an end, Peter is still looking up at the chimpanzee. Odo isn't ignoring him. In fact, when he's not distracted by activity in the gas station, Odo looks down at him with the same relaxed interest that Peter shows looking up at him. When dusk comes, the air cools a little, and still the ape does not come down. Peter opens the trunk of the car and pulls out his sleeping bag and Odo's blanket. The ape hoots. Peter gets close to the tree and lifts the blanket in the air. The creature reaches down to grab it. He climbs back into the tree and wraps himself up cozily. Peter leaves fruit, slices of bread spread with peanut butter, and a jug of water at the foot of the tree. When it gets dark, he lies down for the night in the car. He is exhausted. He is worried that Odo will flee during the night, or worse, attack someone. But he falls asleep with a last, pleasing realization. It is likely the first time since his African childhood that Odo has slept under the stars. In the early morning, the fruit and bread slices are gone, and the jug is half empty. When Peter emerges from the car, Odo comes down from the tree. He raises his arms towards him. Peter sits on the ground, and they embrace and groom each other. Peter gives Odo a breakfast of chocolate milk and egg salad sandwiches. At two other gas stations along the way, the same tree-dwelling scenario is repeated. Peter twice has to call the airline to change their reservations, at a cost each time. During the day, as they drive across America, he finds himself at regular intervals turning his head to glance at his passenger, astounded again and again that he's in a car with a chimpanzee. And he senses that Odo, who is otherwise much taken by the landscape going by, does the same thing, turns his head at regular intervals to glance at him, astounded again and again that he's in a car with a human being. And so, in a constant and mutual state of wonder and amazement, and a little fear, they make their way to New York City. Peter grows nervous as they approach the metropolis. He worries that Lemnon has played a trick on him, that at Kennedy Airport he will be stopped and Odo taken away. The ape stares at the city, his jaw slack, his eyes unblinking. On a side road on the way to Kennedy, Peter stops the car. Now comes the hard part. He must inject into the ape a powerful animal sedative called Cernulin, prescribed by the veterinarian. Will Odo attack him in retaliation?
Look, he says, pointing away.
Odo looks. Peter jabs him in the arm with the syringe. Odo hardly seems to notice the prick, and in a few minutes falls unconscious. At the airport, because of the nature of his cargo, Peter is allowed to go to a special bay to unload the ape. He assembles the cage and, with considerable effort, heaves Odo's limp body onto a blanket on the floor of it. He lingers, his fingers hooked around the metal bars. What if Odo doesn't wake up? Where will that leave him? The cage is put on a dolly and wheeled into the labyrinth of JFK. Peter is accompanied by a security guard. When the customs official has gone through all the papers and verified his flight ticket, Odo is taken away. Peter is told that if the captain gives his permission, he will be able to go in the hold during the flight to check on him. He races away. He goes to a car wash, cleans the car inside and out, drives to Brooklyn. The prospective buyer proves to be a difficult man who magnifies every fault in the car and dismisses every quality. But Peter didn't practice politics for nearly 20 years for nothing. He listens to the man without saying a word, then restates the agreed-upon price. When the man makes to argue further, Peter says, "That's fine. I'll sell it to the other buyer." He gets into the car and starts it. The man comes up to the window.
"What other buyer?"
he asks. "Just after I agreed to sell it to you, another buyer called. I said no because I made a commitment to you. But it's better for me if you don't want it. I'll get more money that way." He gets the car into gear and starts reversing out of the driveway. The man waves.
"Wait, wait! I'll take it!" he yells.
He quickly pays up. Peter flags down a taxi and returns to Kennedy. He pesters the airline with his worries about Odo. They assure him that, no, they won't forget to load the ape onto the plane, and that, yes, he will be loaded in the top hold, which is pressurized and heated, and that, no, there have been no reports of him stirring, and that, yes, he gives all signs of still being alive, and that, no, Peter can't see him just yet, and that, yes, as soon as the plane is at cruising altitude, they will inquire about Peter going to see him. An hour into the flight, the captain gives his permission, and Peter goes to the back of the plane. Through a narrow door, he enters the top hold. The light is turned on. He spots the cage right away, tethered to the wall of the plane with straps. It's set apart from the first-class luggage. He hurries to it. He is relieved to see Odo's chest rising and falling evenly. He puts his hand through the bars and feels the warm body. He would go inside the cage to groom him, but the airline has added its own padlock to the door. Except for the odd trip to the restroom or for a meal, Peter stays next to the cage the whole flight. The flight attendants don't seem to mind him being there. The veterinarian told him that a chimpanzee can't overdose on Cernulin. Twice during the flight he gives Odo an extra jab. He hates doing it, but he doesn't want the ape to wake up in such a noisy, strange place. He might panic.
Enough of this, Peter thinks.
He promises that he will never subject Odo to such egregious strains again. The ape deserves better. A flight attendant enters the hold half an hour before the plane is due to land. He must return to his seat, she tells him. He does as he is told, and promptly falls asleep. When the plane bumps to a landing early in the morning at Lisbon's Portela Airport, he groggily looks out the window and it is he who feels panic racing through him. His heart jumps about his chest. His breathing is labored. This is all a mistake. I'll just turn around. But what about Odo? Lisbon surely has a zoo. He could abandon the ape in his cage at the entrance, an animal foundling. An hour after all the other passengers have picked up their luggage and moved on, he is still waiting in the arrivals area. He spends most of that hour in a cubicle of a restroom near the luggage carousel, weeping quietly.
If only Clara were with him, she would steady him. But if she were around, he wouldn't be in this ridiculous predicament.
Eventually, a man in a uniform finds him.
O signore, o homem como macaco?
He asks. Peter stares at him dumbly.
Macaco?
The man says, making to scratch his armpits while going, ooh, 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 ooh.
Yes, yes,
Peter nods. As they walk through secured doors, the man chats amiably in Portuguese to him. Peter nods, though he doesn't understand a word. He remembers from long-ago conversations between his parents that this is what Portuguese sounds like, a slurred, mournful whisper. In the middle of a hangar, the cage is resting on a luggage cart. Some airport workers are standing around it. Again, Peter's heart jumps in his chest, but this time with gladness. The men are chatting about the macaco with evident interest. Odo is still unconscious. The men ask questions to which Peter can only shake his head apologetically.
Ele não fala português,
says the man who brought him in. Sign language takes over.
O que o senhor vai fazer com ele?
Says another man, his hands waving in front of him, palms up.
I'm going to the high mountains of Portugal, Peter replies. He cuts a rectangle in the air with a finger, says, Portugal, and points to the top right of the rectangle.
Ah, as altas montanhas de Portugal. Lá em cima como os rinocerontes,
responds the man. The others laugh. Peter nods, though he doesn't know what has amused them.
Rinocerontes?
Eventually, their work duties call. His passport is examined and stamped. Odo's papers are signed, stamped, and separated. One set for Peter, one set for them. There. A man leans against the luggage cart. The foreigner and his macaco are good to go. Peter blanches. In the frenzy of the last 2 weeks, there is one detail he has forgotten to address. How he and Odo will get from Lisbon to the high mountains of Portugal. They need a car, but he has made no arrangements for buying one. He puts his palms face out.
Stop!
I need to buy a car.
He shakes his fists up and down, mimicking hands on a steering wheel.
Um carro?
Yes, where can I buy one? Where?
He rubs thumb and forefinger together.
O senhor quer comprar carro?
Comprar, that sounds right.
Yes, yes, comprar carro. Where?
The man calls over another, and they discuss. They write on a piece of paper, which they hand to Peter.
Citroën,
it says, with an address. He knows citron is French for lemon. He hopes this isn't an omen.
Near,
he asks, cupping his fingers towards him.
Sim, e muito perto, taxi.
He points to himself, then away and back.
I'm going and then I'm coming back.
Sim, sim,
the men nod. He hurries away. He has brought with him substantial Canadian and American cash, in addition to traveler's checks, and he has his credit card for extra surety. He changes all his money into escudos and hops into a taxi. The Citroën dealership is not very far from the airport. The cars are strange, roly-poly things. One has lovely lines, but it's expensive and too big for his needs. Finally, he decides on a very basic model, a dorky gray contraption that looks like it was made from tuna cans. It has no frills at all, no radio, no air conditioning, no armrests, no automatic transmission. It doesn't even have roll-down windows. The windows are cut in two horizontally, and the lower half hinges up to rest against the top half, like a flap held up by a clip. Nor is there a hard-top roof or a glass rear window, only a piece of sturdy fabric that can be detached and rolled back, flexible transparent plastic window included. He opens and closes a door. The car feels rickety and rudimentary, but the salesman expresses great enthusiasm for it, praising it to the sky with his hands. Peter wonders at the name, which isn't a name at all, only an alphanumeric code, 2CV. He would prefer an American car, but he needs a car right away, before Odo wakes up. He interrupts the salesman with a nod. He will take it. The man breaks into smiles and directs him to his office. Peter's international driver's license is inspected, papers are filled out, money is taken, calls are made to his credit card company. An hour later, he drives up to the airport, a temporary license plate taped to the inside of the car's rear window. The transmission on the car is clunky, with the gear stick poking straight out of the dashboard. The engine is noisy and the ride is bouncy. He parks the car and makes his way back to the hangar. Odo is still sleeping. Peter and the airport employee wheel the cage out to the car. They transfer the ape to the back seat. Right then, a problem arises. The cage, even folded up, doesn't fit in the tiny trunk of the 2CV. There's no question of strapping it onto the soft roof. It has to be left behind. Peter is not bothered. The thing is a nuisance, and besides, Odo hasn't used it at all. The airport man is amenable to taking it. Peter checks one last time that he hasn't forgotten anything. He has his passport and papers. He's pulled out the map of Portugal. His luggage is jammed into the trunk. The ape is in the back seat. He's ready to set off. Only he's exhausted and thirsty and hungry. He steadies himself.
How far to the Altas Montañas de Portugal? He asks.
Para as altas montañas de Portugal, cerca de 10 horas, the man answers.
Peter uses his fingers to make sure he has understood. 10 fingers, 10 hours. The man nods. Peter sighs. He consults the map. As he did in the United States, he decides to avoid large cities. That means turning away from the coast and driving through the interior. Past a town called Alhandra, there is a bridge across the Tagus. After that, the map promises settlements that are so small they receive the minimal cartographic designation, a tiny black circle with a blank center. A couple of hours later, after only a quick stop at a cafe in a place called Porto Alto to eat and drink and buy supplies, he can keep his eyes open no longer. They come upon Ponte de Sor. It's a pleasantly bustling town. He eyes a hotel longingly. He would happily stop there. Instead, he drives on. Back in the countryside, he turns off onto a quiet side road and parks next to an olive grove. The car looks like a gray bubble about to be blown across the landscape. He leaves food next to Odo. He thinks to lay his sleeping bag across the front seats, but the seats are too far apart. Nor do they recline to any extent. He looks at the ground next to the car. Too rocky. Finally, he gets in the back and works Odo's heavy body onto the floor of the car. He lies across the back seat in a fetal position and promptly falls into a deep sleep. When Peter awakes late that afternoon, Odo is sitting right next to his head, practically on it. He's looking around. No doubt he's wondering what new trick the humans have pulled on him. Where is he now? Where have the big buildings gone? Peter can feel the warmth of Odo's body against his head. He's still tired, but anxiety revives him. Will Odo be angry and aggressive? If he is, there's no way Peter can escape him. He lifts himself slowly. Odo embraces him with both arms. Peter embraces the ape back. They remain interlocked for several seconds. He gives Odo some water to drink and feeds him apples, bread, cheese, ham, all of which disappear in quick, full mouthfuls. Peter notices a group of men a ways off, walking in their direction along the road. They're carrying shovels and hoes on their shoulders. He moves to the driver's seat. Odo hops into the passenger seat next to him. He starts the car. Odo hoots at the rumble of the engine, but otherwise stays put. He turns the car around and returns to the road. Like most emigrants, his parents departed the high mountains of Portugal in a state of want, and they were determined that their children would have different, better lives in Canada. As if stanching a wound, they turned their backs on their origins. In Toronto, they deliberately avoided fellow Portuguese immigrants. They forced themselves to learn English well and passed on neither their native language nor their native culture to their son and daughter. Instead, they encouraged them to move in wider circles and were delighted when each married a non-Portuguese. Only in their last years, once their identity engineering had succeeded, did his parents relent a little, and did he and his sister Teresa, on occasion, get a glimpse into their long-ago former lives. It came in the form of brief stories supported by family photos. A few names were floated, and a hazy geography was sketched, centered on one place name, Tuizelo. That was where his parents came from, and that is where he and Odo will settle. But he knows nothing of the country. He is Canadian through and through. As they drive in the fading light of day, he notes how pretty the landscape is, how busy the rurality. Everywhere there are flocks and herds, beehives and grapevines, plowed fields and tended groves. He sees people carrying firewood on their backs and donkeys carrying loaded baskets on theirs. The night stops them and sends them to sleep. He moves to the cramped back seat. At a late hour, he is vaguely aware of Odo exiting the car through the door, but he is too knocked out by sleep to check on him. In the morning, he finds the ape sleeping on top of the car, on its fabric roof. Peter does not rouse him. Instead, he reads the guidebook. He learns from it that the peculiar tree he keeps seeing, stocky, thick-limbed, the trunk dark brown except where the precious bark has been neatly removed, is the cork tree. The parts of the trees that have been stripped glow a rich reddish brown. He vows from then on to drink only from wine bottles that have been cork-stoppered. Visigoths, Franks, Romans, Moors, all were here. Some did no more than kick over furniture before moving on. Others stayed long enough to build a bridge or a castle. Then, in a sidebar, he discovers that faunal anomaly of northern Portugal, the Iberian rhinoceros. Was that what the man at the airport meant? This biological relic, descended from the woolly rhinoceros of earlier glacial ages, existed in Portugal in shrinking pockets right up into the modern era, with the confirmed death of the last known specimen taking place in 1641. Hardy and fierce-looking, but mostly benign, a herbivore, after all, slow to anger and quick to forgive, it fell out of step with the times, unable to adapt to the shrinking space given it, and so it vanished, though with occasional claims of sightings to this day. In 1515, King Manuel I of Portugal offered an Iberian rhinoceros as a gift to Pope Leo X. The guidebook has a reproduction of the Dürer woodcut of that rhinoceros, incorrectly single-horned. He peers at the image. The animal looks grand, ancient, unlikely, appealing. Odo awakes as Peter is preparing breakfast on the camping stove. When Odo sits up, and even more so when he stands on the roof of the car, taking in his surroundings, Peter is again struck by his situation. If he were in this foreign land alone, it would be unbearable. He would die of loneliness. But because of his strange companion, loneliness is pushed away. For that, he is deeply grateful. Even so, he can't ignore the other feeling troubling him at the moment, which seems to liquefy his innards. Fear. He can't explain the sudden onset of the emotion. He's never been subject to panic attacks, but perhaps this is what they feel like. Fear melts through him, opening his every pore, causing his breath to shorten and quicken. Then Odo climbs down from the car, ambles over on all fours to sit and stare at the camping stove, amiably disposed, and the fear goes away. After breakfast, they hit the road again. They cross villages with stone houses, cobbled streets, sleeping dogs, and observant donkeys. Places of stillness with few men and the women dressed in black, all of them older. He senses that the future comes like the night in these settlements, quietly and without surprise, each generation much like the previous one, and the next only shrinking in numbers. In the early afternoon they reach, according to the map, the high mountains of Portugal. The air is cooler. He is puzzled. Where are the mountains? He wasn't expecting soaring, winter-clad Alps, but he didn't expect an undulating, barren savanna either, its forests hidden away in valleys without any peaks anywhere. He and Odo cross plains of enormous gray boulders, each sitting on its own in the grassland. Some of these rocks reach past what would be the second floor of a house. Perhaps to a man standing next to one, there is something mountain-like about them, but it's a stretch. Odo is as intrigued by the boulders as he is. Tuizelo appears at the end of a winding road on the edge of a forest, tucked in a valley. The narrow, sloping, cobbled streets wend their way to a small square with a humble, gurgling fountain at its center. On one side of the square is a church, on the other a café, which also appears to be a small grocery store and bakery. These two institutions, each plying its own wares, are set amidst modest stone houses with wooden balconies. Only the many vegetable gardens are large as fields and neat. Here, there, everywhere, chickens, goats, sheep, lazing dogs. Right away, he is taken by the tranquility and isolation of the village. And his parents came from here. In fact, he was born here. He can hardly believe it. The distance between this place and the house in the heart of Toronto, in Cabbage Town, where he grew up, seems immeasurable. He has no memories of Tuizelo. His parents left when he was a toddler. Nonetheless, he would give the place a try. "We've arrived," he announces. Odo looks around with a blank expression. They eat sandwiches and drink water. Peter notices a small group of people in a vegetable garden. He reaches for the dictionary. He practices a phrase a few times. "Don't move. Stay in the car," he says to Odo. The ape sits so low in the car seat that he's barely visible from the outside. Peter gets out of the car and waves to the group. They wave back. A man shouts a greeting. Peter goes through the small gate and joins them. Each villager steps forward to shake his hand, a smile on his or her face. "Hola," he says each time. When the ceremony is over, he self-consciously recites his phrase. "Eu quero uma casa, por favor," he says slowly. "I would like a house, please." "Uma casa, por uma noite," says one. "No," he replies, as he flips through the dictionary. "Uma casa por viver." "No, a house to live in." "Aqui, em Tuizelo," says another, his wrinkled features expanding in surprise. "Sim," Peter replies. "Uma casa aqui, em Tuizelo, por viver." "Yes, a house here in Tuizelo to live in." Clearly, immigration is unknown in these parts.
Meu Deus, o que é que la coisa?
A woman gasps. He guesses that the horror in her tone has nothing to do with his request to live in the village. She is looking beyond him. He turns. Sure enough, Odo has climbed onto the roof of the car and is observing them. The group makes various startled, fearful noises. One man grips his hoe and lifts it in the air somewhat.
No, no, he's friendly,
Peter says, his palms raised to appease them. He rifles through the dictionary.
Elle est amigable, amigable.
He repeats the word a few times, trying to heed the tonic accent and get the pronunciation right. He retreats to the car. The group stays frozen. Already Odo has attracted further attention. Two men are staring from the café, as is a woman from her doorstep and another from a balcony. Peter had hoped to ease Odo into village life, but the notion is foolish. There are no degrees to amazement.
Amigável! Amigável!
He repeats to all. He beckons to Odo, who clambers down from the car and knuckle-walks to the vegetable garden with him. The ape chooses not to go through the gate, but to leap onto the stone wall. Peter stands next to him, stroking one of his legs.
Macaco,
he says to the group, to help with what they are seeing.
Macaco amigable.
A friendly ape. The people stare while he and Odo wait. The woman who first noticed Odo is the first to relax a little.
¿E él mora como señor?
She asks. Her tone is open, touched by wonder.
Sim,
he replies, though he doesn't know what mora means. One villager decides that he's had enough. He turns to move away. His neighbor reaches for him, but in doing so he stumbles. The result is that he pulls hard on the first man's sleeve as he seeks to regain his balance. The other man, in turn, loses his balance momentarily, cries out, flings his arm back to throw off the other man's hand, and walks off in a huff. Odo instantly feels the tension and lifts himself onto his legs, following the departing man with his eyes. Standing on the wall as he is, he now towers over the group in the garden. Peter senses their apprehension.
It's all right,
he whispers to the ape, tugging on one of Odo's hands.
It's all right.
He's anxious. Might this be enough to make the ape run amok? Odo doesn't run amok. He sits back down, producing a few inquisitive hoo-hoo-hoos in a rising pitch. Some faces in the group smile at hearing the sound, perhaps reassured by the confirmation of a stereotype. Apes really do go hoo-hoo-hoo.
¿De dónde es que él viene? ¿O qué es que hace?
Asks the same woman.
Sim,
sim, Peter replies, again not knowing to what.
Eu quero uma casa em Tuizelo por viver com macaco amigável.
By now, other villagers have turned up. They gather at a respectful distance. Odo is as curious about the villagers as they are about him. He pivots on the wall, looking, engaging, commenting with quiet whoos and arrrrs.
Uma casa?
Peter repeats as he strokes the ape. The group in the garden at last begins to address his request. They talk to each other, and he can hear the word casa being repeated along with what sounds like names. The conversation widens when one woman turns and calls out to another woman who is standing near his car. This villager responds, and soon another conversation begins there. Occasional verbal volleys are tossed between the villagers around the car and the ones in the vegetable garden. The reason why they don't come together is plain. Between the two groups is the gate, and guarding the gate, like a sentinel, is an ape. Peter thinks that he should perhaps refine his request. A house on the edge of the village would be best. He looks in the dictionary.
Uma casa nas bordas de Tuizelo,
Nas proximidades,
he calls out, somewhat addressing his request to the woman who first spoke about Odo, but intending it for everyone to hear. The discussion starts again, until the woman who has willingly taken on her role as his main interlocutor announces the result of it.
Temos uma casa que provavelmente vai servir para si e o seu macaco.
He understands nothing except uma casa and seu macaco, a house and your ape. He nods. The woman smiles and looks pointedly at the gate. He promptly goes through.